Much, but thank the organizers for allowing me to come here and prolong my stay a little bit in the beautiful but now slightly rainy city of Toronto. So now I have a series of apologies to utter. The first one seems to be the standard apology that this has nothing to do with homotopy theory, except very tangentially perhaps at one point. And the second apology is that I seem to have given this talk a number of times before, and some people have already pointed out that they're not going to hear it a third time. But if I thought to, for those of you who have heard it before, we're having a prize at the end of the lecture for the person who's heard it the most times. Okay, so This is a funny story. This is a paper with Rahul Pandurapande. It's a joint work that, from the point of view of, it's about algebraic cobordism, and purely from the point of view of algebraic cobordism, what we did is we came up with what I think is a very nice and simple presentation of this theory. So that'll be part of what this is about, but that's not where it came from, because Rahul doesn't care about algebraic cobordism so much as he does. He's the one who cares about the Donaldson-Thomas invariants, which are a sort of K-theoretic or scheme sub-scheme version of Gromov-Witten theory. And what the Gromov-Witten or Donaldson-Thomas people do is they create some spaces of things, like spaces of stable maps of curves, or in this case, Hilbert schemes of points, and then they construct some bizarre deformation theory problem, which is a non-obvious one, so that the thing looks like it's really just a finite set of points, and then they count the number of points depending on some other parameter, a discrete parameter like a degree. They build a generating function out of these things, and then they try and study the properties of these generating functions. So I don't know anything about that, but he came to me with this relation that they had for these generating functions, and he said, is this a relation in algebraic cobordism? And could it possibly generate algebraic cobordism, all the relations? And he didn't really know what he was talking about with that, but in spite of that, he was correct. So that's that story. So I think so that's what I wanted to tell you about. So, yeah. So maybe I'll tell you a little bit about algebraic cobordism from its foundational perspective. So again, if you've heard this several times before, I apologize. So it's since this is a conference of topologists, you all know what complex cobordism is. So I won't have to tell you what complex cobordism is. It's whatever it is. We'll get into that later. But there's an algebraic. So it's complex cobordism has a certain. It's unusual among cohomology theories in that it's a universal cohomology theory of a certain type with certain properties. And so what Fabian Morel and I did when we constructed algebraic cobordism is we looked at it in the context of an algebraic version of this axiomatic. So let me give you the axiomatic first. So, So we talk about oriented. And I hate using initials for things, but it's a pain to write oriented cohomology theory all the time. So an cohomology theory on smooth, say, quasi-projective varieties over K is given by the following data. First of all, it looks like a cohomology theory. So you have a contravariant functor to graded rings, commutative, not skew commutative, no signs in the product. And in addition, you have push forward maps. So for each projective morphism, a map, a graded map, F lower star from A star of Y to A star plus D of X, where D is the difference in the dimensions. Okay, so maybe we assume this guy, I should say, is additive. Well, whatever that means. It means it takes disjoint unions to products of rings. So we really only have to consider it on irreducible smooth varieties, and then this makes sense. Okay, and then this should satisfy some axioms. Okay, and they're all fairly evident axioms, so the push forward should be functorial. Yeah, I'll write the, you know, the pullback, the A uppers, the maps there, of course, I'll write as F upper stars. The push forward for the identity map is the identity. And then we have a projection formula, which is just saying that the push forward map is A of X linear. But if you just want it explicit, it says if you have a projective F, then if you take F lower star of F upper star of X times Y, that's X times F lower star of Y. Here F from Y to X is projective, and you have X and A star X, Y and A star Y. Okay. Third, you have some kind of compatibility in transverse Cartesian squares. So this is the most technical of these axioms, because I have to say what the transverse Cartesian square is. So it's a Cartesian square where this is a transverse . So it means it's Cartesian, and everything is smooth, and the W has the right dimension. Turns out that that's enough. So that's what the transverse means. Okay. And let's see. Then we call these things something. An F projective, so we can take the push forwards. Then if you push forward by F and pull back by G, that's the same as pulling back by G prime and pushing forward by F prime. Okay, so those are the structural axioms relating the pullback and the push forward. But that's not enough. You need two other sort of higher level axioms. And the first one is like a homotopy property. So the E stands for extended. So if you have a affine space bundle, so that means, so it's trivial for the locally trivial for the Zariski topology, and the transition maps are given by the affine group. So translations, linear plus translations, an AN bundle, then P star is an isomorphism. And then one more, you need to make a definition before you can state the last axiom. So suppose we have a line bundle, which we view really as a bundle. You know, the map of smooth algebraic varieties. And then we have the zero section, S. Okay. Now, in A star of X, it's a ring. So by ring, I mean unital ring. So there's a unit. So the axiom is, the definition is you can define the C1 of L to be you push forward by the zero section, the unit on X, and then pull it back. So that's just a definition. Okay. Now I've run out of room. Okay, so maybe I should start over here. So on the last axiom is the projective bundle formula, which is just for this C1, notice that this thing, because of the shift in the dimension, this is in degree zero, and the push forward puts you in degree one, and the pullback leaves you in degree one. So this is in here. Okay, so the projective bundle formula says, now if you have a vector bundle, say a rank n plus one vector bundle, and then that leads to the projective space bundle, Pn bundle, with tautological quotient bundle, line bundle, O of 1, then the theory on your projective space bundle is a free A star of X module with basis, the usual basis, one C1 of O of 1, C1 of O of 1 to the N. Okay, so that's that. So, I mean, this is of course, a module over A star of X by the pullback and the multiplication in the ring structure. Okay, so maybe I give some examples. So this is supposed to be modeled on, what you topologists call a C-oriented theory. So for a C-oriented theory, it's a cohomology theory, and then you have push forwards for proper maps with a C orientation, which means a complex structure on the virtual normal bundle. And the difference here is, and one big difference is, I don't assume this is really a cohomology theory in the topological sense. There's no Meyer-Via-Torres axiom. So more accurately, this would be some kind of pre-cohomology theory, but sounds too stupid. So we didn't call it that. Okay, but so how can you get some examples? One class of examples is you just take a topological theory. So if E star is a sort of topological C-oriented theory, like singular cohomology or topological K-theory or complex cobordism, and if you have an embedding of your field into the complex numbers, then what you can do is you can send X to, you kind of double the degrees. E star of X sigma. So I hope this makes sense. You just take the even degree part, you re-index so that A star upper N is E upper 2N of the complex points of your algebraic variety for with respect to the given embedding sigma. And you give the complex points the classical topology. Okay, so that gives you a theory. That's one example. So those are the sort of topological theories. And then you have more algebraic ones. You have like the one very basic one would be the X goes to the Chow ring. So Andreas told us what this was. It's the ring of algebraic cycles mod rational equivalence. And here, maybe I should just say explicitly, what's the C1? If every line bundle is the line bundle of a given divisor D, and if you take C1 of a divisor D, it's just a class of D in the codimension 1 cycles on X. Okay? So that's... example. And a third example, the algebraic K-naught gives an example. So X goes to K-naught of X. But see, that's not really an example because there's no reasonable grading on this group. So you could say, okay, well, I'll just take it as a it's a ring, so I can just take everything in degree zero, but that's not good for the push-forward maps because the push-forward maps have to shift the degree. And so what you have to do is you have to add a fake bot element just to keep track of the shift in the degrees. So you have push-forwards for K-naught because you're dealing with smooth varieties, and K-naught is the same as G-naught, and you have push-forwards for G-naught by the alternating sum of the higher direct images. So, and K-naught always has pullback, so this has the push-forward and the pullback, and then you just use, in other words, if you want to take the F lower star of the class of some vector bundle times beta to the N, where F is a map where the, so what do we give? We give beta degree minus 1. It shouldn't be something in degree minus 1. It's supposed to look like the class of P1, so that's relative, it's codimension minus 1 over a point. And so I guess this should be the usual, you know, it's the alternating sum, the Ri F lower stars of E, these classes in G-naught rather than K-naught, but they're the same. But then I have to multiply by beta to the N, and what did I call D? D was the codimension, so I guess I need a minus D. I think that's probably right. Okay, and here, what's C1 of L? This is a real easy calculation. C1 of L is 1 minus L dual times beta to the minus 1. So it's not hard to figure that out. All right, so that's a nice list of examples. Now there's an important invariant that comes with an oriented theory. So each oriented cohomology theory, A, on smooth varieties, comes with a formal group law. In keeping with the rather ugly tradition of using initials, I'll call this an FGL. So FA with coefficients in A star of the base field K. In other words, FA is a power series in two variables over this ring and satisfies three properties. It's unital, which means just that this is equal to U. And secondly, it's commutative. So, you know, strictly speaking, I guess this means it's a commutative formal group law of rank 1, but I'm not going to say that each time. VU, that's the commutative axiom, and it's associative. Group law is. And so how do I get such a thing? Yeah. Ah, yeah, it's not equal. Sorry, yeah. Thanks. Makes more sense. Sorry. Okay, and this one is characterized, the FA for A is characterized by its characteristic identity, which is that it tells you how the first Chern class of a tensor product is expressible in terms of the first Chern classes of the two bundles. So the thing to note here is, note, very importantly, it's not always true, or it's almost never the case, always true that not in general true that this thing is additive, that C1 of L, maybe I put a little A here to indicate the theory. C1A of M. Oh, that's always true. That follows from the axioms, yeah. So, right, that's a good point. In order for this left-hand side to make sense, you have to be able, it has to, the two elements have to be nilpotent. And in fact, if you go, I think, beyond the dimension, they vanish. That's what you expect. So maybe I'll give some, so examples of this, I mean, of course, for A equals the Chow ring, it is additive. This is the one that the algebraic geometers are most familiar with. And so, pardon me? It doesn't follow obviously from the axioms, but it does follow from the axioms. Okay. So for this one, the point is that if you take O of D tensor O of E on some X, if you take the tensor product of line bundles associated to two divisors, that's the line bundle associated to the sum. And so for my formula for the C1 and the Chow ring, that says C1 is additive. So it's not an example of being a counterexample. So, but what it does, in other words, the formal group law for the Chow ring is just the additive group law. Okay, but another, the other example, the explicit example we had was A star equals this K naught beta beta inverse. And then what's C1 of L tensor M? It's just 1 minus L tensor M dual, which is just the L dual times beta inverse, and it's just, you know, this is 1 minus L dual plus 1 minus M dual, then minus 2 times beta, or I'll put the beta here, beta inverse times beta. So in other words, the formal group law for K-theory is the U plus V minus beta UV. And this is the, if you take the usual multiplicative group and look at it near the identity, which is 1, that's the expression you get for the product. So this is the this is the additive group, and this is the multiplicative group law. So they're really different. You really do get different. Okay. Maybe just say one word why you get this formal group law at all. So how do you get, why? Why does this come about? It just follows, it follows from the projective bundle formula. See, because if you take any x, so you have an arbitrary theory, you're looking at A star of x cross Pn. Well, we know at least additively, the projective bundle formula tells us, wherever it went to, we know what this thing is additively, and in the case of a trivial projective bundle, it's not hard to see that multiplicatively, it's the obvious thing, it's just A star of x join on some variable u modulo u to the n plus 1, where u goes to the module generator C1 of O of 1. In other words, it's not hard to see that that C1 of O of 1 to the n plus 1 really is 0 in the case of a trivial bundle. And so if we just formally define P infinity, or the theory on P infinity, to be the inverse limit over n by the, you know, the system of inclusions of hyperplanes, Pn into Pn plus 1, this just gives us a power series ring, where again, U goes to the system of C1 of O of 1s on the various Pns. It's a compatible family in there. And so if we take now X to be P infinity and do this again, that tells us that if we take the theory on a product of two P infinities, in other words, just look at what happens on Pn cross Pm, this just gives us our power series. This is where our power series ring comes in, where now U is going to, so C1 of, let's call it O of 1, 0, and V, the generator V, the variable V goes to C1 of O of 0, 1, where O of AB by definition means I take P1 star of O of A, tensor P2 star, upper star of O of B. Okay, so an element here, it says elements here are power series, but I can just take the element here given by C1 of O of 1, 1, which is, in some sense, what's P infinity with its O of 1 on it? It's the universal gadget with a line bundle, and two copies of P infinity is the universal gadget with two line bundles. So this O of 1, 1 is the universal tensor product of two line bundles. And now the C1 of O of 1 corresponds to an element here. What element it is? It's the power series. It's the formal group law. And the fact that these three identities are satisfied for this element just follows from the, this one follows from the fact that if you take a trivial bundle, tensor or a line bundle, it's the same line bundle. This one follows from the fact that L tensor M is M tensor L. And this one follows from the fact that L tensor M tensor N, that tensor product is associative. It doesn't matter how you associate it. So these three properties, the properties of tensor product of line bundles apply to this element via this isomorphism, give you that this gadget is a formal group law. Okay, so that's where it comes from. And then it's not so hard to see that it really does work, not just for this example, but for all examples, because I said it's the universal case, and you need the homotopy property to really prove that it's the universal case. Okay, so in this sort of abstract context, let me state our main theorem with Morel, which is okay, so let's introduce algebraic cobordism in this setting. This is a theorem itself in Morel. So let K be a field of... Oh, I forgot something. So before we do it over here, I guess I'll have time here. So we get a formal group law, and there's a universal formal group law. So let's denote by FL and L the universal formal group law. So L is called the Lazard ring. Turns out that this is isomorphic to a polynomial ring in... It has a natural grading, and it's a polynomial ring in infinitely many variables, one in each degree. But the way you can construct it without seeing what this is, without seeing that it's a polynomial ring, is what you do is you just start out with what? You start out with a polynomial ring on lots of variables, and then you form this power series. You just take the stupid power series, which is just U plus V plus the summation aij u to the I v to the j. And this already satisfies this unital property. So you've built that into it. And then you just, then L is just equal to this L tilde modulo the relations that f of uv equals f of vu. In other words, just that aij equals ajI, you just make it commutative. And then you make it associative. And this one is, of course, more complicated to write down. So I won't write this one down. It's an infinite sequence of homogeneous equations in the AIJs. And I guess we give to, I guess what do we give? This is this degree 1 minus I minus J. Okay, so since this is the universal guy, for every theory A, there's a canonical homomorphism, actually a graded homomorphism
from L to A star of K, let's call it phi A, classifying the formal group law of the theory FA. Okay, so sorry for the poor blackboard technique there. I needed to state this. So back to the main theorem with Morel. So let K be a field of characteristic zero, then there is a universal oriented cohomology theory on smooth varieties over K, which we denote omega star, and this is what we call algebraic cobordism. Moreover, this classifying map phi omega from the Lazard ring to omega star of K is an isomorphism. So the formal group law of the universal theory is the universal formal group law. Okay, so I think I don't. There are some other interesting properties about this which are not obvious from this theorem, but I don't think I need them. Who, what? Pardon?
Did I? Omega's not Taylor differentials.
No. No, it's just an omega. It's not.
That's not even the of a D. Put it on your algebra.
Yeah. This is, this is not, the omega star of K is not nothing to do with differentials. It's just the, maybe. Whenever I write this, what I mean is I have my theory omega star, which is a functor, and I evaluate it on spec K. Yeah, general to Z mod. Yeah. Right, and but since this thing is the same as the Lazard ring, the omega star of K also classifies formal group laws. So little remark. Suppose we're given, you know, our favorite formal group law, say F with coefficients in R, we can form the oriented cohomology theory, omega star tensor, if you like, over L with R. So in other words, this is just X maps to, you take this gadget here, omega star of K is by the pullback map an algebra or a module over omega star of X is a module over omega star of K, which is the same as L, and so then we can tensor this over L with R. So that's the definition of this thing, and the universality of omega tells us that this omega star R over L is the universal oriented cohomology theory with formal group law FR. And in this regard, so for our examples, you can take, let's let omega star plus equal omega star tensor over L with Z, where our F now is just the additive group law with coefficients in Z. So this is the universal additive theory. Then this thing is isomorphic. It maps to the Chow ring as a theory because the Chow ring is also additive, but it's isomorphic to it. And the multiplicative theory, this is the definition, say multiplicative and with parameter beta invertible, here F is equal to U plus V minus beta UV. This maps naturally to my K naught beta inverse, and this is also an isomorphism. Okay, so that characterizes these two theories as the universal additive and multiplicative one, just to give you some ideas. Okay, so how are we doing? Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't think, unless I need to later on, I won't say anything about the construction. So how do we prove this theorem? We actually can, well, we construct the omega. And we construct it, but it's kind of funny, we construct it not as an oriented cohomology theory, but as something much weaker. And then we prove that it has all the properties of an oriented cohomology theory. And this much weaker thing is obviously universal among the category of these much weaker things, and that gives us the universality. So the hard thing is that you basically follow your nose and construct a much more ridiculous object, which no one would really care about. But it turns out that automatically it has all the nice properties. Okay. Ah, yeah. So maybe just the remark is, Morel and I construct this omega star explicitly. We give an explicit presentation for it, explicitly but horribly. In other words, it's you know, it's a presentation that only a mother could love, right? So it's not something you're really too happy with. But it works. I mean, it's you know, it gives you the theory, but it's not something you'd really like. So, but you should note, of course, Quillen gives a, I'd say, beautiful presentation of complex cobordism of some differentiable manifold X, say MUN of X, where MUN of X is just equal to, you take the set of F from Y to X, where F is proper, and then there's this technical, oh, it's a plus a theta, this is this technical thing, theta is a C orientation, don't worry about that because we don't care, some extra data, and X and Y is also a differentiable manifold, and N is the codimension. It's the real dimension of X minus the dimension of Y. And then modulo, the cobordism relation, where what's a cobordism? If you have a gadget like this from some Y to X cross the real line with some theta, some C orientation, such that the F is transverse to 0 and 1, then you can intersect, you can pull back X cross 0 and X cross 1, so you get an F0 from some the fiber over X cross 0, which is, of course, equal to X, and this is equal to X cross 1. You have the fiber, so you also have the restriction of your theta. And the cobordism relation just says that F, these two are then equivalent. That's the cobord. What happens over 0 is the cobordant to what happens over 1. So you could ask, can you make a presentation similar to, for R omega, similar to this? So is omega n of x equal to what? You take the collection, well, of course, here, sort of isomorph, you take the collection of all f from y to x, where now the x is going to be smooth, but y is smooth. F is projective, because that's our algebraic version of proper, say. And we don't care about the C orientation, because everything is like a complex analytic anyway, so that automatically has a canonical C orientation. And N is the same thing, because now this is a real dimension, it's just a complex dimension, it's dimension of X minus dimension of Y. And then modulo, some kind of cobordism. So the answer is, if you take the cobordism to be the naive generalization of what sits here, where you just replace the real line with the affine line, the answer is no, it's not. So this doesn't work, is definitely false, if for by cobordism we simply replace the real line
with the affine line and have all the conditions the same. In other words, you have a map of y to x cross the affine line, which is transverse to 0 and 1, and you identify what happens over 0 with what happens over 1. That's too weak a relation. But, so this is the, with Ponder-Aponde, this works. If we use so-called double-point cobordisms. So let me tell you what this is, and then I'll give you the applications to the Donaldson-Thomas theory. And also there's a nice, it gives you a nice presentation of other theories. You get a funny presentation of K-naught via this this theorem here, and you get a funny presentation of the Chow ring by the additive version of that theorem. Okay, so to tell you, no, I want to tell you what this is, double point cobordism. So let me tell you what that is. See what that is here. Okay. So first, the first definition is not double point cobordism, but a double point degeneration. And you'll see why it's almost like cobordism, but with a little bit of singularities allowed. So what's a double point cobordism? You start out with C0, a smooth pointed curve over our field K. So that means 0 is a K rational point. And we have F from Y to C, a flat morphism in smooth varieties over K. Then this thing is a double point degeneration at 0 if, let's see, two things are satisfied. The inverse image of 0 can be written as a union of two components where S and T are both smooth. So this is as a scheme, so it's reduced and they're smooth and they intersect transversely. And secondly, S intersect T. So these are, since the map is flat, these S and T are both automatically divisors on Y, codimension 1, and the intersection has codimension 2 and is smooth. Or, and then you allow the degenerate cases, or something is empty. So in other words, we could just allow the case where there it's really a smooth fiber, that's allowed, and we could allow the case where we have two disjoint components that just don't intersect. So we also allow that. But Over's not in the audience, so I don't have to worry about that. Okay. Okie doke. So that. No, I don't know. Yeah, I guess that's also okay, yes. If Y is empty, it's also okay. But let's not. Yeah, we could do that. Okay, now, if we have such a gadget, we get, I mean, it's obvious out of this you get two smooth varieties, right? But you actually get a third smooth variety of the same dimension as the other two, which is not the intersection, because that's not the same dimension as the other two. So what is it? Let's let D be this intersection, and I'll just draw a picture here. So the degeneration looks like this. Here's the total space Y. Here we're mapping to the curve C, and here's the fiber over 0. This is my S, and this is my T, and this is my D for double point. And then what I can do is I can consider the normal bundle of D in one of the pieces. And that's a line bundle. So I can take the projectivization of that, you know, compactification of that line bundle, which just means I take the projective space of the rank 2 bundle, the normal bundle of D and F, plus the trivial bundle on D. And this is a P1 bundle over D. Okay, so I can hear the objections rising from the back benches that, this is non-canonical because why is F better than T? And it isn't any better, but it's not any worse because the condition of this thing tells you that the normal bundle of D and T is actually the inverse of the normal bundle of D and F. And since P of a vector bundle doesn't depend on, if you twist the vector bundle by a line bundle, it doesn't change the isomorphism class. So that says that P of N D and F plus O of D, that's the same, I can tensor with this, with its inverse, that's the same as P of O of D plus N of D and S inverse, which is the same as P of O of D plus N of D and T. So actually, there's no real choice involved here. Okay. So, now moving along. Okay, so we have this data, and now what's a double point cobordism? So on some X is a projective map. F from Y to X cross P1, such that, first of all, if I take P2 composed with F, this is a double point degeneration over or at 0 in P1. And secondly, P2F is smooth over a neighborhood of 1 in P1. So it just means it's the same as saying since the map, is that what I mean? Smooth. Is that all I mean? That's too strong. It's just that the inverse image of 1 is smooth. Okay. Now, if we have such a double point cobordism, we can then. Yeah, so let's see, where was I? Ah, yeah. Remember, here's our question. Is omega n, this group, say you have isomorphism classes on these things, or maybe the free abelian group on such things, modulo some relation. And in fact, it's a theorem that the way we construct this starts out with gadgets like this. So these are more or less, by definition, generators for this thing. And then the question is, what are the relations? So either there's also a natural way of mapping these things. So in fact, let me just say, let's let Mn of X be the free abelian group on these maps, F from Y to X. So F is projective, Y smooth, and N is equal to the dimension of X minus the dimension of Y, and modulo isomorphism. So isomorphism as a map. And then we can map this thing to omega n of x, our universal theory, by sending f from y to x. Well, y has a structure morphism, let's say p to spec k. We send this guy to, you take p upper star of 1, and then take f lower star of it. And this will be in, if you look at the dimensions, it'll be in omega n of x. Okay, and our little lemma, which I proved with Morel, let me call this map pi x, is that pi x is surjective. Okay, now if we're given a double point cobordism f from y to x cross p1, let's let y1 be the smooth fiber, sort of f inverse of x cross 1, and then we write s union t as f inverse of x cross 0, that's the fiber over 0, and then we have our p1 of this bundle, this d is going to be our s intersect t, and then we have the normal bundle of d and s plus o of d to d. Let's call this thing p of f. Then we have the following element in this group of generators. We have r of f, which by definition will just be, the dimensions are right, it'll be y1 mapping to x. Notice that y1 sits inside of y, which maps to this and then projects to x, and everything is projective. And then we can take this minus s mapping to x minus t mapping to x, and then plus this p of f mapping to x. Okay, so the theorem with Ponderapande is that if we take this m n of x modulo all these rfs of the right dimension, so maybe I put an m star here, this thing, first of all, these things go to zero under this map pi, and the natural map here to omega is an isomorphism. So that gives us the sort of elementary presentation. Okay, and maybe I don't say anything at all about the proof. Maybe if I have time at the end, I'll say a few words. But let me cut to the chase here. So some application to these Donaldson-Thomas invariants. Okay. So this is a completely different world. It doesn't have anything to do with anything I've said so far just yet. So we start out with x, now will be a smooth projective threefold over the complex numbers. And then we consider an algebraic variety, it's actually a projective algebraic variety, Hilbert D of x. And this is the Hilbert scheme of zero-dimensional subschemes, closed subschemes, W of X with, what do you want to say, dimension over C of OW equal to D. So more precisely, you're talking about flat families of such things. Okay. So, and, you know, an open component in this thing, an open subset of a component of this thing would just be the thing parameterizing d distinct points in x. So that thing has dimension 3d, right? But for some reason or other, this thing has a natural dimension 0. And don't ask me why, but this comes from Gromov-Witten theory. If you look first at the case where x is a Calabi-Yau threefold, and you consider a collection of points as actually a curve on x of homology class, an effective curve whose homology class is zero. Sort of a special, you can consider this type of thing, you consider ideal sheaves, parametrizing curves in the given homology class on X. And if you write down the deformation theory of that thing for a collodial, then the expected dimension will be zero. And this type of thing was considered by four authors who go under the name of MNOP. The initials are taking over. So this is Molik, Nekrasov, Konkov, and Pande. And so you can see why all their results are referred to as by MNOP rather than by saying all their names every time. So what they do is they define what's called a perfect deformation theory on, among other things, but on this Hill D of X with expected dimension equal to zero. And the general theory of perfect deformation theories tells you it leads to a virtual fundamental class of that expected dimension. So you get this gadget, the virtual fundamental class, and it'll be something in the Chow group of zero cycles on this projective scheme. So it has a degree, so let's let ND equal the degree of this thing. And then they form the generating function. So Z, almost out of time, of XT, which is just 1 plus the sum . Okay, now there's another power series. Let's let M of T be the so-called McMahon function. It's just the following thing. It's like the product over N bigger than 1, 1 minus T to the minus N to the N. Is that right? No, T to the N to the minus N. There we go. And this is also, if you expand it out, it has coefficients which count the number of three-dimensional partitions. So you know what a two-dimensional partition looks like, a little staircase inside the first quadrant. And a three-dimensional partition looks like a three-dimensional staircase, part of a pyramid inside the first octant. And it counts the number of them of size with n blocks. That's what this thing does. And their conjecture is that this generating function here is just this McMahon function to the degree of the third Chern class of the tangent bundle tensor of the canonical bundle. That's the obvious thing that anybody would suspect. And so I have maybe 2 minutes, so I can tell you how to prove this, at least in outline, and how double-point cobordism comes into the proof. Now, what did they do with this conjecture? There are a bunch of other conjectures that this is related to. And all the ones that have to do with degree zero we can prove by these techniques. But here's a sketch or an outline of the proof. So they prove this. So the conjecture is true for toric threefolds. So we already know what a toric variety is from Mark Walker's lecture. So a toric threefold, it's a smooth toric threefold. Okay. Then they also prove the following proposition. If F from Y to C is a projective double point degeneration of fiber dimension, say degeneration over zero of fiber dimension 3, And if y1 is f inverse of 1 is smooth, so now we have our same picture. We have the general fiber y1 is a smooth projective threefold, and we have two components here, s and t, with our d and our p1 bundle, p of f lying over d. Then, and these are all threefolds. This is a threefold, that's a threefold, this is a threefold. Then the generating function for y1 is the product divided by this error term. Okay? So what does that mean? In other words, if you send y to this generating function in the group of power series with z coefficients with leading term 1, it obviously descends to the things, to this m minus 3 over c by linearity. This is just a free abelian group on smooth projective threefolds. And this says it descends, this relation says it descends to this modulo all these double point cobordisms. And this is just omega minus 3 of c. But we know by the theorem with Morel that this is just a Lazard ring in degree minus 6. And, well, this group here has no torsion. So if we want to check identities here, we only need to check on a Q basis of this tensor Q. And the Lazard ring, it's known from topology, the Lazard ring, this is just the same as mu minus 6 of a point. And back to Herzebruch, or I don't know, mu minus 6 of a point over Q is the Q vector space on P, CP3, CP2 cross CP1, and CP1 cubed. But these are all torque varieties. So the conjecture is true for the generators of the Lazard ring, and that means it's true in general. So that's the proof. Sorry for going over time. Thanks very much. Yeah, there are two different things going on here. This is a... You know what this is. Okay. But what you don't know is that you can think of it as not just parametrizing d-dimensional subschemes. You can think of it as parametrizing curves of homology class 0.
Parametrizing 0 cycles of degree b, not d-dimensional.
No, that's... It's 0-dimensional subschemes whose structure sheath is dimension d over c. So it could be non-reduced guys. That's what I mean by that. And then, so this is the part that I can't tell you about because I don't know anything about it, but this is a special case. You can think of it as parametrizing a completely non-obvious. See, this is like a sort of, in an open subset, you say, well, this is just parametrizing deformations of d-distinct points with some limiting properties, what happens when they come together. And in fact, you can think about this as an entirely different problem as parametrizing subschemes whose associated homology class is a curve of an effective curve homologous to zero. So if you look at it a different way, you can write down a different, completely non-obvious deformation problem for which this is the solution. But if the solution has the wrong dimension, the expected dimension would be zero. If you write, so, you know, you have to believe me because I didn't tell you what the deformation problem is.
The dimension you're talking about right now is not the dimension of this.
Right. It's not the dimension of this. So there are lots of problems in deformation theory which have obstructions. Right? You have a tangent space and you have obstructions. And the expected dimension, if you have a perfect theory, there's only those two vector spaces that are important. And the expected dimension is the difference of the two. But it can happen that the equations, the equations are in the obstruction, are in the tangent space. And they land in the obstruction space, but it can be that the equations are redundant, that you have more equations than you really
you have fewer equations than you really think you do, and the actual dimension is much bigger than the expected dimension. When that happens, there's a whole yoga. There are various people that did this. I guess Fontecchi and Behrens are the ones that wrote maybe the most all-encompassing view of this, that if you have that, you can write down a class in the, maybe there should be a Q here, in the Chow ring. It's some characteristic class. You have some Chern class of the difference of these of two vector bundles evaluated on what they call the canonical normal cone. And you evaluate that and you get some cycle of the right dimension, maybe with Q coefficients. And the cycle has the right dimension even though the actual space of deformations for your problem doesn't. And that's what they do here. They construct a deformation theory which wants to have zero dimensions even though this thing has much bigger dimension. And that's how they get this virtual, what they call virtual fundamental cycle. This is what people in Gromov-Witten theory do when they construct the Gromov-Witten invariants. You have a moduli space of stable maps. It has a certain dimension, and what you want to do is you want to take classes, you're mapping to some x, you want to take classes on x, pull it back to the universal space, and pull back by the sections of the moduli space, because you're talking about curves with so many sections, take the cup product, and integrate them over the moduli space. But it only is really correct to do that if you want to get a number out of it, and very often the moduli space has too big a dimension. So you have to get some cycle which behaves like which has the right dimension and behaves like the fundamental class in a reasonable way. So this is sort of a well-established procedure in Gromov-Witten theory, and they do an analogous procedure in this setting of Donaldson-Thomas theory where you're talking about subschemes rather than curves mapping to the variety. And somehow, so that's how they cook up this zero cycle with, say, rational coefficients, and you can have a degree, and you make this generating function out of it. So I should also say that it seems to be quite difficult to do this, because I mentioned this very briefly, the natural setting for this is for a Calabi-Yau threefold. And somehow they're able to get away from the Calabi-Yau condition, the description I gave is really in the Calabi-Yau case. And what they do in the general case, it's not really that. They look at the theory for curves of a given homology class and then kind of take a limit as the homology class goes to zero to get this virtual class. So I'm kind of, what I said was only even close to accurate in the Calabi-Yau case. There's a limiting procedure that they use to get it in the general case. But in any case, they can define these generating functions in general for a general smooth projective threefold, and they do in general satisfy this relation, and that's what you need in order to get the algebraic cobordism to give a solution to the conjecture. Yeah, Chuck.
Somehow or other I missed the connection to the words Donaldson and Thomas.
Yeah, well, Thomas was a student of Donaldson, and he's the one that he was the one that I believe in his thesis first considered this version of Gromov-Witten theory where you're looking at Hilbert's scheme of ideal sheaves of curves on a threefold rather than looking at stable maps of a curve to a threefold in the moduli space of that. So I think that's why it's called that.
Which are the invariants?
The invariants are these generating functions. Or the coefficients of the generating functions are the invariants. Yeah. Ah, yeah. So that's of course a dream that we've had. Program would be you do what Spencer Block did for algebraic cycles. He starts out with the Chow ring or Chow groups defined as cycles mod rational equivalents, and then says, well, that's just the H0 in some simplicial abelian group. And then you write down the whole simplicial abelian group and you get motivic cohomology as the homology of this thing. And maybe you say, okay, well, see now, when we first did this, we had three different kinds of relations we had to put together to define the quotient of this M. This M is a reasonable gadget. It's just all maps, right? Mod isomorphism. And then we had three different kinds, and no one can make a simplicial gadget out of three different kinds of relations, right? It's, unless you're completely insane. So at least with this, there's some hope of possibly making that program work. you know, I think it would be a nice problem. I have no idea if it's a feasible problem. I mean, the difference, you don't expect to get a simplicial abelian group that gives you M, this, the theory that it's trying to get is MGL, which you can build in the Morel-Voyevodsky stable homotopy category. And there's, it's, you know, you can't get this presumably from a simplicial abelian group. You need some simplicial space, at least. And, you know, one hint that this says to me that you need a space is that this MX is already, you take the category of maps and you're looking at the isomorphism classes in that category. So it suggests that you want to have at least B of that category in as one of the building blocks in this simplicial gadget if it exists. And then you have to kind of fit, I mean, you can write, you have to generalize these double, you have to say, you know, you have a double point generation over some face in a simplex, and you have to put that together into, say, a cube, so you have to say what a double point degeneration is of a double point degeneration. And that's probably not so hard to do, but so I think you can write this down, but to prove any reasonable properties of it is probably fairly difficult. To show that this really gives you MGL is maybe not so easy, but I think the you know, there are a number of flavors of definitions which sort of immediately spring to mind from this, but I don't think anybody's been able to really grapple with them and give any reasonable idea that it should really give you MGL. That's it. Yeah. Let's see. Well, a miracle appears. I mean, I'm glad you asked this. So in just 1 minute, I can tell you why these work. Just the story behind it is Pandara Pandey asked me if these are relations, and he viewed it as saying, can you get the Lazard ring as through just these relations? And I said, well, I've seen these relations before. I was looking at some other problem, but it's inconceivable that this would actually give you the Lazard ring because there are far too few relations. And then he showed me a few tricks you can do with them, and then started to think another direction, and it turned out to be correct. But this goes back to what I said about our construction of omega. So this omega is constructed as a universal gadget with three things, really. Just push-forward maps. There's no pullback maps for F projective. Well, you have pullback maps for F smooth, not arbitrary maps. And you have a first term class operator that satisfies a formal group law. And that's how we construct this. And we construct it in the universal way with this sort of very crude data. And now you can compare this with what you have. So this thing with the double point cobordism, let's call this little omega, this has this thing. This has F upper lower star, and this has an F upper star. And then you can also construct this guy for, say, globally generated semi-ample L. And the way you do this, it's very simple. If you have some L over X, which is generated by its global sections, and you have some Y mapping here, what do? You just pull back the L and then replace Y with D, where D is equal to the zeros of a general section. And so this works for F generated by its global section in characteristic zero because you have a Bertini theorem which says that the zeros of a general section are okay. And since this omega already sort of you build in these double point relations build in a homotopy invariance, it doesn't matter which section you use. Okay, so you have sort of this, you know, but then what about the formal group law? How do you see the thing is if you this is only partially defined, it's not defined for other bundles. But if you had a formal group law, you could write an arbitrary bundle as the difference of two very ample bundles, and then you could use the formal group law to define this operator on an arbitrary L and hope that you're in business. And so you have to define, you have to see if you can get this thing to satisfy a formal group law. And then this is something that Fabian showed me. The formal group law, I wrote it as coming from something rather formal, you know, just this projective bundle formula, but it's really just saying, what happens if you're on P1 cross P1? Remember, I was saying you were looking at this O of 1, 1. So what you really want to do in this geometric viewpoint is you want to look at a general section here of O of 1, 1. It's just something, you know, the variables here are x and the variables here are y. It's just a sum of xi, yi's from 0 to 1, right? It's a quadric. And in fact, it's the diagonal quadric in here. And the formal group law says that the diagonal quadric, this is really, you know, this thing here is equal to C1 of O of 1, 1, because it's given by the zeros. And you want to, you know, you want to say C1 of, well, this diagonal is linearly equivalent to this plus this. Right? And that gives you a double point degeneration. So that says C1 of O of 1 is equal to C1 of O of 1, 0 plus C1 of O of 0, 1 minus sort of P1 mapping to this point here. Right, that's the double point degeneration gives that, and that's the beginning of a formal group law. So you're happy, but then you try it for, instead of P1 cross P1, you try it for, say, P2 cross P1, or P even worse, P2 cross P2, and you see you don't really quite have that because now the degeneration is going to be some curve or some surface. And instead of getting a constant coefficient here, this is something coming, your coefficients of your formal group law have to come from the base. You get a P1 bundle, which is non-trivial. So then you have to say, well, now I have to decompose that, and you have to keep on breaking things up into more and more pieces. But the point is that the double point cobordism is sort of the minimal what you need to do that, but in fact it suffices to take any degeneration like this and actually break it up into pieces so that all the terms you're left with come from constants, come from the base field. So that's what you have to do in order to make it work. That's sort of why it's enough. But you know, from the beginning, why it's enough, I think, is just that Pandurapande was an optimist. That was it.
Yeah, I think we should get to our reception, which...
Oh, yeah, sorry.